Well, if you turn in your Bibles to Psalm 77 again. Psalm 77. And hopefully we'll be looking at that in a little bit more detail this morning. Now, there's an evangelistic booklet at the back of the church, at least I hope it's there. And it's written by John Blanchard, and it's called Where is God When Things Go Wrong? And it's written for unbelievers who ask that question. It's probably the most commonly asked question. Certainly, when I'm in the open air, that's probably where the question that people ask more than anything else. But of course, that's not just a question for unbelievers, is it? It's a question which I would suggest is asked frequently, if not more so, by God's people. And of course, if you're a mature believer here this morning, you might be able to answer it quite simply and quite immediately. You might say, well, look, God is there in the good times and the bad. God is sovereign. And so he puts his children through the mill at times to make them more dependent on him, to discipline them, and ultimately always to make them more like his son. And maybe at that point, you would be tempted to quote Romans chapter 8, verse 28. We know that all things work together for the good of those that love God and those who are called according to his purposes. So that's it. In a sense, we can all go home, can't we? If that's the answer, where is God when things go wrong? Well, it's a pretty simple answer, isn't it? And of course, we know that that is true. God is there in the good times and the bad. And all things do work together for the good of them that love the Lord. And even when it doesn't seem like it, Gerard's been trying to hammer home the point recently that God is the God of the corkscrews, as he calls it. But if this morning we think we can answer that question really easily and really simply, and if that answer just rolls off the tongue, then I'd wonder, has that belief ever really been put to the test in your life? Have you ever been challenged spiritually, physically, or materially? And it's led you to that point of asking, where is God at the moment? Does God really care about me? Does he have any interest in my life? After all, it's easy to quote Romans 8:28 when you're sailing on a calm sea with the sun on your face. But when that calm sea becomes a raging storm, that answer doesn't run so easily off the tongue, does it? Of course, it's nevertheless true. But this morning, I want to look at a man in Psalm 77, a man called Asaph, the psalmist. And he was in the midst of that storm. And he was asking the question, has God deserted his people? Has God deserted me? And we're going to run through this psalm and we're going to see how God delivers him from his fear and his worry. So the first point is the backdrop. What's the background to this psalm? Why is the psalmist in this spiritual despair, this time of spiritual and emotional despair? Well, Psalm 77 was probably written soon after the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonian army led by Nebuchadnezzar. The city was sacked. Men, women, and children had been slaughtered in their hundreds and their thousands. Many others had been taken as captives to Babylon. And some had simply been left in the ruins of Jerusalem, reduced to absolute poverty. And worst of all, the temple, the place where God met with his people, had been completely destroyed and burnt to the ground. It must have been a horrific scene, mustn't it? You know, a few years ago, I saw a television program that followed the events of the Boxing Day tsunami in 2004. And I've got a reasonably strong constitution. Someone once said, Tim, you're not really an emotional chap. And they were right. I hide my emotions well. But this program was truly horrific. And it was awful. And it shook me to my very core. After the tsunami, where thousands, hundreds of thousands of people had been swept to their deaths, there was absolute chaos. Bodies lay unburied for days, and many people were desperately looking for their loved ones. And they followed news footage and people's personal footage of husbands desperately searching for their wives, wives desperately searching for their husbands, parents searching for their kids. Panic, heartache, and pain gripped that area after the tsunami. And if you think back to the news reports after that terrible event, maybe, just maybe, you'll start to get an idea of what's going on at the destruction of Jerusalem. In Psalm 79, we're painted a picture of what's going on, and it's startlingly similar to what I just said. In the first four verses, I'm reading it in the NIV, it says, O God, the nations have invaded your inheritance. They have defiled your holy temple. They have reduced Jerusalem to rubble. They have left the dead bodies of your servants as food for the birds of the sky, the flesh of your own people for the animals of the wild. They have poured out blood like water all around Jerusalem, and there is no one to bury the dead. We are objects of contempt to our neighbours, of scorn and derision to those around us. It's horrific language, isn't it? Horrific words. And as the psalmist looks at God's people who have been slaughtered in their hundreds and thousands, as he looked at Jerusalem, you know, Zion, the city of God, and yet the walls and the houses have been destroyed. And as he looks at the temple, the house of God, and it's been completely reduced to rubble, the psalmist asks the question that I think every single one of us here would surely ask. He asks God, where are you in this? Have you deserted your people? So let's look at the psalm in a little bit more detail. Secondly, we're going to look at the first nine verses and just try and work out what's being said. The psalmist is tired, but he can't sleep. Verse 1. I cried out to God with my voice. To God with my voice. He repeats himself, doesn't he? And immediately we can see the intensity and the desperation of his cry. The psalmist isn't speaking softly, is he? He's shedding tears and he's wailing and he's pleading with God. But what is he pleading? We'll look at verses 2 and 3. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. So the psalmist is troubled. And yes, there is a national crisis. But actually, the root of this problem for the psalmist is a personal spiritual crisis. He's crying out to God, and yet he receives no answer. That's why verse 2 we read, "My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted." What does it mean that his hands were stretched out? Well, if you think of news footage of a famine-struck land, and you see the British Red Cross truck, and it rolls into town, and it begins delivering aid to the people. What you see is a sea of raised up hands. And those hands are saying more than voices could ever say. Those hands are simply shouting out, "Help me." And that's what the psalmist is crying out. He's lifting up his hands, pleading to God to help. And yet it seems for the psalmist that his prayers are bouncing off the ceiling. Verse 2, he says, "My soul refused to be comforted." There may even be a sense that the psalmist is trying to rekindle something of the presence of God that he once enjoyed. One commentator puts it like this. He says, "Asaph recalled the songs he had sung at the temple, even when on night duty. He had lifted his hands in the sanctuary and received the Lord's blessing. But now he lifts his hands and receives nothing." So the psalmist is crying out to God, but he receives no answer. And verse 3, he says, "I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed." When he attempts to find God, he's overwhelmed with fear. Now, Judah and Jerusalem had continually, for centuries, turned away from the Lord and run after false gods and idols. And the Lord had promised long ago in Leviticus chapter 18 that if they ran after idols, if they committed the sin of idolatry, that there would come a time when they would be thrown out of the land. And God would judge his people for their disobedience. Well, now in Psalm 77, that judgment has come, hasn't it? Jerusalem lies in ruins. The Lord has shown his displeasure. And God, it seems, has turned against his people. And therefore the psalmist is overwhelmed with fear. God in his anger has brought destruction on his chosen people. So how then, Asaph says, how can I possibly approach this angry God? And that's why he's troubled. He's overwhelmed. How can Asaph cry to the Lord for help when it's the Lord who's behind his desperate situation? Imagine this. Imagine a poor man is in debt to a loan shark. And this man, he can't pay. And therefore, he's got to run. Because if the loan shark catches him, well, you know, it won't be pretty. Well, who can this poor man turn to for help? He can maybe go to the authorities. He can maybe seek friends' help or something like that. But the one person he can't turn to for help is the loan shark himself. After all, he knows that if the loan shark should catch him, that he'll be beaten up or worse, killed. He can turn to almost anyone else, but he cannot turn to the guy who's chasing him for money. And in that same sense, that's how Asaph feels. If God is responsible for my awful situation, if God is angry, then he's the last person I can possibly turn to. And verses 4 to 6, this spiritual depression, this despair that the psalmist is under, it's now leading him to a point where it's having a physical effect. Look at verse 4. You hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. He can't sleep. He can't speak. There's just in these words a sense of total despair. So what does he do next? Well, verses 5 and 6. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. The psalmist tries to think of happier times, doesn't he? He tries to think of times in the past where he's received blessing. But does thinking of happier times help him now? Well, no, it doesn't. If anything, it twists the knife. It's like a teenage girl in her bedroom crying over her sweetheart, who's no longer her sweetheart, and looking at photos of him. It doesn't help. It just makes it all the worse. And that's what's going on with the psalmist. He thinks of the days of old, and yet it only serves to remind him of the desperate situation he's in. And actually, more specifically, it only serves to confirm to him that God has walked out on his people, that God has turned his back on them. After all, the good old days were good because God was blessing his people. And so now Jerusalem lies in ruins, the temple is destroyed, and God's people have been slaughtered. What does that say about God's relationship with his people? And as Asaph thinks on this, his emotions get the better of him. He just cannot contain himself. In a cry of absolute despair, he asks the question, or the questions that are haunting him. Verses 7 to 9. He says, will the Lord cast off forever? And will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? And I suppose these six questions that we see, really they could be summed up in one, couldn't they? Has God deserted his people? Has God in anger finally walked away? Well, if ever there was a depressing beginning to a sermon, this is probably it, isn't it? There's no joy, no pleasure in these words. The first nine verses of this psalm speak of absolute despair. And yet, you know, I think those questions that the psalmist asks, I think that more than likely they'll resonate with many of us. Because many of us can find ourselves in that same situation as Asaph. Maybe circumstances in your life have spiraled out of control. Maybe everything, it seems, is just going wrong. And you wonder to yourself, why would the Lord put me through this? Surely if God cares, then surely he would deliver me. Surely he would deal with this situation.
Maybe health. Maybe circumstances. Maybe finances. Whatever it may be. Maybe you can't see any good reason for the situation you're in. And therefore, the only reason you can see is that the Lord has turned his back on you. Or that the Lord simply doesn't care. And maybe you've prayed to God about a particular situation for days and weeks and months and possibly even years. And yet it seems that God has just left you on your own. And you pray, and it seems as though your prayers are bouncing off the ceiling. And you can't understand the situation. You say, Lord, there can be no good reason for this. And Lord, I want this so much. Lord, don't you realize how desperately I feel about this? And yet still, there's no answer. And like Asaph, after so much time praying and finding no answer, you get to that point where you say, well, look, Lord, have you just deserted me then? I've cried to you, and yet you're just ignoring me. And like Asaph, you wonder, has God deserted me? Well, maybe you're wrapped with guilt. There's a guilt you just cannot get rid of. And like Asaph, you fear to approach the Lord. You know nothing of delighting in God. You know nothing of enjoying his presence. Every time you come to him, it seems you're overwhelmed with fear. And every day, that question haunts you. Will the Lord turn his back on me now? Maybe just one more sin. One more failure. One more bad day when I don't love God as I should. And you get to the end of that day and you wonder, surely God has turned his back on me now. You wonder, how could God be gracious to me? Has God forgotten to be gracious? I wonder, do Asaph's words, does Asaph's situation resonate with you this morning? Well, if it does, then I hope you'll take notice of verses 10 to 20. Because in verse 10 especially, we see the hinge on which the whole psalm turns. Verse 10, we read, "And I said, this is my anguish, this is my pain. But I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord." Now, what's significant in that? Asaph has already tried to think of happier times. And yet he's found no peace. If anything, it's simply twisted the knife. Well, the key is verse 11. I will remember the works of the Lord. And you'll see in our English translation, the word Lord there is in capital letters. Now, that's significant. The most accurate translation of it, I suppose, would be Yahweh. Or as many know the Lord, Jehovah. Whenever you see that word Lord in capital letters, you know that the word is Yahweh. And what is Yahweh? Well, it's God's personal name. When people spoke to King George VI Everyone would address him as Your Royal Highness. But his family, they called him Bertie. Bertie was his personal name. It was the name he used with his family and friends. And this name, Yahweh, is God's personal name. If we can say it reverently, it's the name he uses with his friends. It's the name he uses with his people. And when you look at verses 1 to 9 of this psalm, you'll see that that word, that name, never appears. Asaph is speaking to God in an impersonal way. And yet now he says, I will remember the works of Yahweh. He's beginning to see the Lord in his true light. That name Yahweh, what is the significance? Well, way back in the book of Genesis, one of the first times that that name is used is with Abraham. And we read this, then he, that's the Lord, said to him, I am the Lord, I am Yahweh, who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to inherit it. And a few verses on the same day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abraham. Yahweh is significant. That personal name of God is significant because it represents that truth that Yahweh is a covenant-keeping God. That's why we sung our opening hymn, God of the Covenants, Triune Jehovah. And throughout the history of the Israelites, God had kept his covenant with them. He had shown his protecting, keeping hand over them. And that's why in verse 11 and 12 we read, surely I will remember your works, your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your works and talk of your deeds. It seems the dark clouds of spiritual despair are beginning to break up. And finally the psalmist is seeing the Lord in the true light of his character. He is not a God who deserts his people. He is not a God who turns his back. He is the God of the covenant, the God of the promise, who has promised his people, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And so verses 13 to 15. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. That's not the clearest translation. Far better in other translations, which say, your way, O God, is holy. So God is holy. But he's not just holy. No, he's powerful as well. Look at verse 13. Who is so great a God as our God? You are the God who does wonders. You have declared your strength among the peoples. This God, my God, Jehovah, Yahweh, he has shown his power. And how has he shown his power and his strength? He's shown it through the deliverance of his people. That's why verse 15 we read, you have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. The Lord has shown his strength and his power and his holiness in the keeping of his covenant, that he has redeemed his people. He has saved his people and has never let them go. And what's the clearest example of this? Well, the clearest example of this for the psalmist in verses 16 to 20 is the Exodus. Think back to the Exodus. The situation for God's people standing at the edge of the Red Sea was pretty bleak, wasn't it? The Egyptian army was raining down on them. An army of men who the previous night had lost their firstborn son. An army of men who are grieving and out for revenge. And should the Egyptian army reach the Israelites at the edge of the Red Sea, God's people will be slaughtered, every single one of them. In fact, the situation is so bleak that we read this. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, you have taken us away to die in the wilderness." And yet God hadn't deserted his people, had he? As they stood at the edge of the Red Sea, as things looked as bleak as they could be, at this crucial point, the Lord, through Moses, divides the Red Sea in order that the children of Israel can pass through on dry land. And the psalmist refers to that. He uses poetic language, doesn't he? You read, "The waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you, and they were afraid. The depths also trembled." Now, if you were at the house party this year, I don't know whether you were. If you came to the beach, you remember there was a time when our illustrious pastor led an expedition of men into the sea to a sandbank that way yonder. And, we all got ready and ran down. And it was our Hasselhoff moment, wasn't it? You know, you run into the sea, you can see the clear crystal water before you, and you go, "Oh, I'm going to conquer that water, I'm going to dive right in." And you're running, and you get there, you take a step in, oh, it's a little bit colder than I thought it would be. You get a little way in, and suddenly you're not running anymore, you're walking, and before long you're sort of walking like that into the sea. You set out to conquer the sea, but the sea conquered you. And yet here the psalmist, as he paints a picture of the Lord, of Yahweh, approaching the water, the scene is very different. We read, "The waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you. They were afraid. The depths also trembled." Now, it was bonfire night last night, and what do you do with your pets on bonfire night? You lock them indoors, don't you? And when we used to have a rabbit, we would lock the rabbit in a hutch. And as all the fireworks were going off around her, where was the rabbit? Well, the rabbit was in the corner of her hutch, shaking, petrified, and cowering in the corner. And yet that's the picture that the psalmist paints of the water before God. The water of the Red Sea cowered in the corner as the Lord approached, because he was so great. And having laid the pathway through the sea, what do we read? Verse 20. "Your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron." The Lord led his people. They couldn't see him. It says, your footsteps were not known. And yet the Lord was nevertheless there. And at a time when everything looked bleak, the Lord intervened and the Lord delivered his people. So what has Asaph learnt? Well, if in the first part of this psalm he was in despair, by the end of this psalm he has realised this, that God has never before failed his people. So why should he begin to doubt him now? If at every other point in Israel's history, when things looked bleak, the Lord stepped in and intervened, then why should the psalmist doubt the Lord's love and care and concern now? Our God, says the psalmist, is a covenant-keeping God. And he has promised to care for his people. So what does this say to us? Well, I just want to really draw two things out of this. And the first is the power of persistent prayer. At this spiritual low point, at the very beginning of the psalm, what do we read Asaph say? He says, I cried out to God with my voice. To God with my voice. There's desperation in his words. And yet what do we read? And he gave ear to me. Now, verse 1 is really a summary of the entire psalm. And so as we look at this psalm, we can see Asaph is crying out to God, and yet he receives no answer, and yet nevertheless he continues to cry. He stretches out his hands to God in verse 2, and he cries out, help me, but it seems that no help comes. He finds no comfort in prayer, verse 3, but he carries on regardless. He's overwhelmed with fear, yet still he cannot keep away from God. Have you ever seen a moth buzzing around a light bulb, and the light bulb is hot? And the moth touches the light bulb and it has to get off again, but it can't keep away. It keeps on going back all the time. That's what Asaph is like. He's overwhelmed with fear as he approaches God, but he cannot keep away. And even though he doubts that there's anyone else who can help, as much as he doubts that God cannot help, nevertheless, he cannot stay away from the Lord. I cried out to God with my voice, to God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. Eventually, the Lord gave ear to him. It seemed as though the Lord wasn't listening. It seemed as though the Lord just didn't care. But he did hear. And he did care. And eventually, the psalmist finds what he has been looking for. He doesn't find deliverance from his situation. He finds the Lord. That's what he's been looking for all along. So maybe, as we said earlier on, maybe this morning, you're in that spiritual storm. You seek the Lord, but you find no answers. You cry out to him, maybe you shed real tears, and still no answer seems to come. Well, You're in a situation where you've got two choices, aren't you? The easier thing to do is to step back. The easier thing is to be numb to God, to say, Lord, you won't hear me, Lord, you don't hear me, and in a sense to turn away and to simply stop seeking him. Because seeking him hurts. Because when you bring your problem to God, when you bring it to the Lord and still no answer comes, it's painful, isn't it? And it's as though someone's driving a knife into your chest every time. And so the easier thing to do is to step back and simply not to pray and not to try and spend time with the Lord and maybe not even to come to God's house because there you have to meet with him. And yet that's not what Asaph would advise, is it? He cries and he cries persistently. until he finds what he was really looking for. He finds the Lord. And lastly, where does Asaph find the Lord? Well, he finds him in the Lord's act of redemption, doesn't he? He, like every other Old Testament writer, generally as they look back to the Exodus. Because it was the greatest example of God's deliverance. And yet, every act of deliverance in the Old Testament is a picture or a precursor to the greatest act of deliverance that we find in the New. And so we this morning are more privileged than Asaph. Asaph could look back to a time of God's deliverance, and yet he could only look back to a picture. We can look back to what the Exodus pictured. We can look back to the cross, when God really did deliver his people once and for all. And yet, just like Asaph, even though he looked back to the Exodus, even though we can look back to the cross, just like Asaph, our reaction should be the same, shouldn't it? If he has never deserted his people before, why then? Why would he desert me now? If we think of our Saviour in the Garden of Gethsemane, in agony as he thought of the looming cross, so much pain, so much desperation that even sweat drops of blood are falling from his brow. And yet still he carried on. Still he walked towards the cross. And as we think of the Lord on the cross, suffering the wrath and the anger of his Father, crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And yet we think that, Christian friend, he was there for you. And he was there for me. He was there to deliver his people. If he was willing to do that, if he loved you enough to do that, then don't you think he cares about your situation now? Don't you think he still loves you? Christian friend, his love for you has never been anything less than infinite love. And so this morning, if you are in that spiritual storm, and if this morning, like the psalmist, you are wondering, has God turned his back on me? Well, Christian friend, this morning we can say no. He will never turn his back on his people. Because there was a time in the past when God turned his back on his Son. And he did that for you. And he did that for me.